It's Wrestling Observer Radio. Garrett Gonzalez and Dave Meltzer here on a Friday night with our special guest, Dr. Alex Patel. He's a Toronto-based critical care physician and associate professor heavily involved in COVID planning efforts. How's it going, Dr. Patel?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a real, it's kind of harrowing time, really, for our culture. And I guess to start with, we all have so many questions, you know, because it's all come on so soon and and so strong and so powerful. And I guess the first one is people will say, you know, if you look at the statistics, there's not really that many deaths yet. The whole world is in a shutdown, so to speak. And I think I kind of know why, but can you kind of explain it for the layperson on why everything is so severe, I guess, right now?
Sure. So if you look at the absolute death rate of the virus, you see, as you said, that the numbers perhaps are not striking compared to something like SARS or MERS, which had much higher death rates. The key, though, here is the amount of cases and how fast they occur. So the perfect example would be Italy. If you look at Italy, Italy has had a drastic increase in the number of cases in a short period of time, and their death rate is much higher than a lot of the other countries. And the effect of that is something that we call flattening the curve, or what we're trying to do, which is that if you have a lot of cases at once, you will overwhelm a medical system simply because the denominator is so high in terms of the total number of cases that even a small percentage, and we estimate the percentage that need critical care is about 5%, becomes too much. We don't have enough ventilators, we don't have enough doctors, we don't have enough places to care for these people, and you increase the death rate. So the reason that you're seeing all of these measures that we call social distancing, such as shutting down of events and large gatherings, encouraging people to isolate if they're sick or travel, is to prevent that and to flatten that out so that you're not seeing that immense caseload right up front, that you're sort of spreading that out, if you will, over a number of weeks so that you're not overwhelming the medical system and that they can care for people who do get sick. Because even though the numbers are small, when you start to infect more and more people, even that small percentage can become too much for the medical system to handle.
Now, you know, there's so many questions as far as like what is safe to do, what is not safe to do in real life. And I guess, you know, and obviously a lot of people who are listening are wrestling fans and MMA fans and sports fans. And so as far as like when it comes to these events, both as a spectator and also as a participant, you know, what are the dangers? Because we know pretty much everyone has shut down except for, I think, horse racing, and UFC is running tomorrow night, and WWE and AEW are still trying to run, and pretty much nobody else is trying to run. And is that a good thing or a bad thing that these other companies are trying to run? And what kind of dangers, is there dangers of for the participants? Because they're running empty arena shows, so it's not really for the fans that there's dangers as far as the fans and large gatherings, but there's still participants, and they're younger and in shape and all that, they're fit people. But so what do you kind of think of, but still, like, look, the NCAA shut down all their sports, and these are all, you know, athletes in their late teens and early 20s, mid-20s at the oldest.
Yeah, so to start with, you have to understand how the virus is spread. So it is spread through droplets, which means that you need respiratory droplets or droplets from your mouth to either land directly on another individual or to land on a surface that then that person would touch in the appropriate amount of time where it was still alive. And, you know, we estimate that to be anywhere up to 24 hours, or the best estimates are around 3 hours for most surfaces. So that's how it's spread. So it's not necessarily spread through airborne, which is how, like, tuberculosis is spread, where if you're just in the same arena as someone, you're going to get it because you cough the same air. This is more direct, close contact. So in terms of, you know, why we're setting down these events, it's because you are in close contact in arenas with people. People touch things. You can touch them. And that's why fans are encouraged not to go to these events and have large gatherings. Specific to MMA and wrestling, the issue with those events and having them empty arena and having the competitors is that they are still in close contact, right? By definition, when you're wrestling, or when you're doing MMA, you know, it's not as big a distance from these people. You know, horse racing, they're kind of far apart. So you can sort of argue that if you were doing that, it's not as bad, perhaps. But in wrestling or MMA, they are in close contact with each other. Now, the one thing is, we do know that The virus is spread mostly when you are sick. And, you know, there's a certain percentage that we call super spreaders who are really sick, and they usually end up in hospital or ICU. But that if you're asymptomatic, although the risk is not zero, it's low that you spread. So I'm imagining that the UFC, as well as the WWE, are going to be screening their talent, I would hope. And if they are sick, they wouldn't be competing. So that's probably one way they're going to mitigate that. Is that risk nothing? I mean, no, look at Rudy Gobert, for instance, right? Rudy Gobert had it and spread it to Mitchell. They're in close contact. I would argue they're perhaps not even really in as close contact as you would be if you were wrestling or doing, you know, an MMA match and you were on the floor, right? So there's certainly a risk to the performers. The risk is higher, much higher, if somebody has symptoms. I would hope these companies would, you know, isolate those people, and I'm sure they are. But, you know, the risk is not zero.
Now, one thing, you know, it's an immune, you know, if you're strong, if your immune system is weakened, that's where the it's more devastating. Now, what would, with MMA fighters, I mean, the one thing is that they've all, or most of them, have cut severe amount of weights the day before the fight and during that week. So that would, in theory, I mean, I don't know this to be fact, but I would think that that would weaken their immune system, which is something that pro wrestlers really aren't doing. Pro wrestlers are just at their natural weight and you know, whatever. They might be tired from travel, although, you know, they're probably less tired and doing less travel now than they've ever had in their lives. So they're probably, it's probably not the worst, you know, in that sense. But like for an MMA fighter who's, let's just say, 155-pound guy who's all of a sudden 135 pounds the day before his fight, you know, I would think that that could compromise your immune system.
Yeah, I mean, you know, intuitively it would. Obviously, they haven't, you know, studied people who've drastically cut weight, but we do know that the highest risk populations outside of age, where age is probably the biggest, are people who have chronic diseases. And the two big ones are if you have a risk of diabetes, which we know can affect your immune system, and heart disease, and some of the medications that are associated with heart disease, as per some recent literature, that can affect this. And we know smoking. So we know these things can affect you if you have underlying damage. We're assuming most of these athletes don't have that. But yeah, if you're drastically cutting weight, and dehydrating yourself, you know, you're probably not in tip-top physical shape. And as such, you could have a more severe course if you contracted the virus. I would think that does stand to make physiological sense.
Now, one thing, and I've been asked this from many people, you actually, you know, contacted me, and we kind of had a email discussion over this. And I've also talked to, you know, one of my closest friends who's a high-level doctor as well, who basically told me last night, you know, do not go to the gym. You know, which is funny because a couple of days earlier, she had told me, you know, you don't have anything to worry about. You're in shape. And then last night, it was just like, don't go to the gym. And it was kind of like, you know, among many freaky things that have happened in the last couple of days, you know, one by one. I mean, it's a weird thing. Garrett and I were watching AEW on Wednesday night, and everything was cool. And then Rudy Gobert, the NBA stops play, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, Trump's travel ban, all like within a few minutes. And it was just like, at that point, it was like, it didn't all happen at once. And I mean, we've seen it from covering New Japan Pro Wrestling and Japanese Pro Wrestling, that it's been going on for weeks and weeks. But all of a sudden, you know, now it's hitting us personally quickly. Go to the grocery store, no toilet paper. So now there's a feeling that we are not in a normal situation. And the next question is like, I mean, I know we don't know a time frame. I see people, like when it comes to sports events and stuff, I've been seeing some people kind of like want to reschedule stuff in June. I wonder if that's early or late, or, you know, like that, and some later than that. I mean, but, you know, we don't really, I mean, what do we know as far as time frame, estimated time frame? Is it going to get worse before it gets better? I guess just for people in their normal life.
So the best data we have is from China, because they've had the initial outbreak. And what we know is it's something called a beta coronavirus. And the one that it's most close to is SARS, which was around in 2003. And we know that SARS by July was gone. And we know that it didn't really come back. We don't know for sure what's going to happen to this virus. We don't know whether the warm weather affects it. We don't know whether or not it's going to be mutating seasonally like influenza does, or whether it will stick, you know, closer to SARS. But, you know, the hope is that it's closer to SARS just because that's the one it's most similar to. In terms of China's experience, the numbers now are dropping off. So they had about 10 new cases. And they've done, if you look at their chart, done a good job of seeing that the new cases are coming down. The first case was December 31st that was reported. So you're looking at a timeline of about 3 months. So optimistically, we would think that 12 weeks might be the soonest that we'll start to see this drop off. Of course, we will see if China gets reinfection rates or what happens. But that would be the optimistic. For our hospitals, we're planning pandemic or surge planning currently until the end of June. So we anticipate at least until the end of June that we're going to be in the middle of this. And after that, we will see what happens. But the hope is that that would be the best case scenario. In terms of leveling off, if you look at the graphs, some countries have leveled off. Japan, as you mentioned, with cutting down the shows and schools and everything, has really flattened their curve, and they've done a good job of that. Korea has done that. Italy is still rising. The United States is about 500 new cases a day. They've likely not hit their peak given their population, I would suspect. So you're going to see a rise in that, I would think, until you start to see leveling off occur.
You know, one of the reasons I was so happy to hear that you and Dave were talking, you were going to come on, is because of the amount of misinformation that's out there. And I'm dealing with it in my job pretty much all day long. But if you were to advise, if someone came to you and said, hey, you know, I want to learn more about this stuff, what's a good website? What's a good maybe a Facebook community or something where people can actually go and get real information? Because I think that the misinformation is really what's out there. And if you're not careful, you know, there's some really bad stuff. And if you followed it, you know, some of that stuff is dangerous out there.
Sure. So there are a couple of websites. I mean, the CDC is the website for the United States where they have a lot of good information. If you're more interested in sort of numbers and you really want to see what's going on, John Hopkins has a website that they track all the cases. There's a website called Worldometers where they track the world cases and they'll give you a breakdown of all the new cases. And then I would advise you to look at your local area and where you are. So for instance, in Ontario, you can go to ontario.ca where I work and it'll give you twice a day all the new cases that have come out in your area. And similarly, depending on where you are, if you go to your municipality's website, there should be somewhere where you can get official information that is being released. Now, the important thing is to not only know how many new cases are in your area, but how are they being linked? So in a lot of areas, the cases are still linked to travelers, which means that we know the person who either got the disease was in very close contact to a traveler or they're a traveler themselves. Eventually, that may turn into community-based spread like you have in the Bay Area, which is why you know, you should avoid things a little more aggressively there, because we assume at this point that we can't trace how you're getting it and that it could be out in the community and really anyone who's sick could have it. So those are the kind of things you want to keep an eye on if you're in your area, as opposed to sort of, you know, reading random blogs or Facebook shares.
Just from a selfish standpoint, because my son has Crohn's disease, does that make him more susceptible?
It would depend on his treatment regime. So if he was on immunosuppressives like corticosteroids or some of the biologics, then yes, it could make him more susceptible. For people that are on immunosuppressives like that, we'd advise you to speak to your physician about what to do. So in a lot of cases, they will just continue them because they think that the benefits outweigh the risk. In some cases, they may change the dose or get rid of ones that they think are perhaps too trying on your immune system in preparation for this. But again, I would not make that decision alone. I would speak to the physician that's best managing your care.
Yeah. As far as restaurants, should you avoid them? And just going like to malls and things like that.
So malls in general, when we talk about social distancing, so when we're talking about where there isn't large community spread, where we're, you know, not something like Italy, but where we're looking more at travel-based cases, but there is a bit of a rise, it's not listed as one of the strongest determinants. So we know when you're in close contact with people, that's a risk. That's why we're closing down events. That's why schools and workplaces, we ask people to work from home, are higher risk. In malls, you know, the most important thing is if you don't touch people as much, if you keep a bit of a distance, we say about a meter, so if you're far apart from people, it's probably less risky overall. Restaurants, you know, provided that you know the people you're dining with in close contact are healthy, it's going to be less risky, but the risk is still there. I mean, you know, could it live on the food you get? Very few cases, if any, have ever been linked to that, but theoretically it's possible that it does live on certain mediums. So nothing is zero risk, but I would say those are lower risk for sure, especially in times where you don't have large community spread.
Yeah. So as far as you know, now another aspect is economic, and until people are, you know, ready to go back to movies and ready to go back to restaurants and ready to travel again and ready to use hotels again and everything like that, our economy is going to be in a major funk. I mean, I guess we don't, we just sort of have to wait it out. Is that the best, you know, thing that you could say, or is there any more we can kind of, you know, ascertain from all this?
You know, unfortunately, we don't have enough data to know exactly what's going to happen. We do know that if you do social distancing, it will save lives. And we can see that when you look at what's happened in countries that have been aggressive about this. Singapore, Japan, you can look up their curves and see that they've really not had spikes in cases. So we know it works. Is the economic effect there? Yes. I mean, of course it is. We're seeing that not only in the stock market, but just individual businesses that are suffering.
Of course.
And of course, that is really bad. And we wish there was some way, of course, that we could help those people. And, you know, sometimes the government is offering workers that are home, and so are some companies offering wages and things like that. But it's going to have an economic impact. But I would argue that an economic impact to businesses is perhaps better than the impact it's going to have on humanity and death rates if we don't adhere to some form of social distancing.
Now, did you have an opinion on, it seemed like the NBA was kind of the domino that started all of these leagues and things to start shutting down. But there were some, and there are still some, who are taking a wait and see approach, whether it's going to be a week or a few more days or whatever. Like, do you think that you know, it was the NBA that kind of created this, you know, for, sort of made people realize that this is the thing. But what do you think about the other companies who didn't react so quickly and follow the NBA?
So I think the NBA initially started in Golden State, where they said they were going to do empty arena. And really, I think for the NBA, the impetus was what happened to Rudy Gobert. So when you have a member of a team that is infected, they have to go back and look at what happened, because he could have been infectious for, you know, at least 4 days, if not 2 weeks at most. So they go back and they look and they see what teams he's played. And I live in Toronto. The Toronto Raptors were one of the teams. And there's video of, you know, him hugging Kyle Lowry. So he's been in close contact with a lot of people. And for all of those people, they need to be isolated for 14 days from the general population in self-isolation. And it doesn't matter who you are. In Canada, our prime minister, his wife contracted COVID, and he is in self-isolation for 14 days. And, you know, you can't screen people and it be reliable if they're asymptomatic. So they do need to actually be isolated until they develop symptoms or up to 14 days. So when that starts happening, the NBA had no choice because there were a lot of teams that were going to have to isolate. So they did, I think, what they could do at that point in terms of having to halt their season. A lot of the other leagues haven't had that. Juventus had a player who tested positive, but a lot of the other leagues didn't have individual players yet. But I think they looked at the NBA and realized that even if they did empty arena games, because a lot of cities where they were having local spread were starting to limit any public gathering. It would be at 1,000, be it 250, whatever the number was. But I think when they started to see that, look, there's an NBA player that got, and if that happens to one of us, it's going to shut everything down anyway, they decided, I think, to start shutting down their leagues in a sort of a domino effect after that. Of course, we know not everything has, and wrestling and UFC are still continuing. In some respects, there are less athletes, I guess. You know, when you look at the NBA in total versus UFC or WWE, there's less in total. And I imagine, you know, if one of them does get it, it's going to obviously shut down things because they're all going to be in close contact. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Now, is there's also a risk, especially right now, because everyone else has done it and because WWE, AEW, and UFC have not, that if something happens there, management will be seen as negligent, I think, by the general public for trying to continue. And that's a big risk for everyone, I think. If nothing happens, nothing happens. But I feel it's like it's a risk. And the other thing too is in its own weird way, in times like this, I think that people, you know, it may be very beneficial. Maybe I don't know for sure, but it may be very beneficial to people to have that distraction, that entertainment, something to focus on other than, you know, the kind of thing of like 3 months of just pure negativity, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a massive WWE and AEW fan, and I watch New Japan. So I would love to come. I'm a big basketball fan, so I would love to come home and watch these things. So, you know, it's definitely when everything shuts down, certainly there is an element of social isolation that creeps in. You go home and whatever you're used to watching on TV, you're doing, you're not doing, you're not going out. So I think, you know, having these things around, there is certainly some value in that, as you point out. They are running empty arenas, so the risk to the general public is going to be hopefully much less.
Yes.
You know, if something happens to one of them where they contract it, or, you know, we know that there's even WWE wrestlers and AEW wrestlers that live together. So if one happens to one, what happens to the other? There's a lot of domino effects that could happen. I'm sure they're weighing all that. Like, they're obviously fully aware that that's a risk. They've seen what's happened in the NBA. I don't know what measures they're taking. Maybe they're asking the wrestlers to self-quarantine when they're not competing. Like, we don't actually know. And that could be something they're doing. Maybe they're not asking them to travel that way, and they're making alternate arrangements. We don't actually know what they're doing to minimize that risk. But, you know, on the surface, certainly, because they are in close contact, there would appear to be a risk there. I'm sure they're doing their best to make sure nobody's sick and that they're minimizing that risk, but it's not zero.
So we do have some questions. Dave asked for some questions on his Twitter feed, and we got some questions. Some of these are probably very simple, but some of these are actually a little bit more in depth. One question was, what are some symptoms associated with the common cold / flu that indicate the illness you have is not coronavirus? And if you feel sick at all, should you try and get tested, or should you only get tested if you have multiple matching symptoms at once?
So a lot of that depends on where you live. If you're in an area where there is still largely a travel link associated with the spread, then unless you have direct contact with someone who's traveled or you've traveled yourself, you don't probably need testing unless, you know, you have that link. In areas where there's community spread, you could certainly have it despite not having the link. In terms of symptoms, we know that fever, cough, and shortness of breath, in that order, sort of, are the most common symptoms. Those can mimic the common cold. Those can mimic influenza or the flu. Some of the subtle differences are that in COVID, you don't get as much of a runny nose and a headache. In the common cold, you often do get a runny nose. In influenza, the headache is pretty common. So that could be subtle signs that you don't have that, but there's no absolute. If you are in an area where you think you want to get tested and you're sick, you can certainly go get tested. But I would caution that not everybody needs to go to hospital. There isn't really a specific treatment they are going to offer you if you have mild disease. And because of that, it's mainly supportive care and isolation. So if you have those symptoms, you could, and they're mild, you don't necessarily have to run and get tested. You can quarantine for a while until you know, you feel a bit better. And then if you want, you can get tested to make sure later. So you don't have to run and get tested right away, provided that you can self-quarantine, because that is really the treatment for this. That being said, though, if there is some reason that you need to get tested either for work or you need some documentation, then I would encourage those that do to go to dedicated testing centers, not to overwhelm your local ER, not to overwhelm your local family doctor where you infect people. If you're going to do that, make sure you know that you avoid contact and have a mask on if you're walking into a common area like that. And I know, you know, in our area, and Trump mentioned today, they're going to set up dedicated centers where they can test for this, where you can go and get tested without the risk of affecting others.
Let's see. So now China is comparable in size to the United States, but obviously far more dense population. With the American population being, you know, more spread out, will that make a difference in the transmission of the disease, or do we even know?
We don't know for sure because we just haven't seen enough you know, sort of data points. But theoretically, yes, if you're not as densely populated, you don't have as many people in your homes, you're not in as close contact, that should, because of the nature of the spread, make it less. Italy, which is more densely populated, you're seeing, you know, a rise in some of those cases where they're perhaps in a smaller area. So again, we don't know for sure. You know, we also, to be honest, don't even really know exactly what the mortality is, because there may be more cases where people are just not testing themselves and they have it. So there could be more people that have it than we know, and the death mortality could actually be a bit lower. So again, a lot of stuff that we don't exactly know. But yeah, because the United States is less dense in terms of its spread out of the population, and theoretically there's probably less people in a house, there is certainly the chance there could be less spread.
So this one comes from the UK. It says many countries in Europe are pursuing a strategy of school and business closures in an attempt to slow down the spread of the virus. The UK is trying a strategy of minimal shutdown with the aim of developing herd immunity in the population. What is your opinion of the UK strategy?
So I think the strategy of the UK, also has less cases overall right now. In general, when we do social distancing, that does include closing schools and working from home, because those are areas where you're in close contact with people and you can spread it. Concept of herd immunity is where, you know, people start to get immune to it because, you know, a large population already has it. And, you know, those people are not going to get it again. We don't really know, you know, how the pattern of it is, and you're going to need pretty high numbers for herd immunity to work. So, you know, it's not certainly preferable, I would think, to social distancing in terms of its effect to reduce the caseload. You run the risk, if you don't do that, you could get a spike in cases and overwhelm the medical system, which is the biggest worry. So I would certainly favor social distancing over that approach.
Let's see. Okay, this is actually one of my good friends sent this. He said that he's got a severe heart illness right now. And he said that he's seen some news reports that ACE inhibitors make it easier for the coronavirus to enter your system. He's got a AFib, severe heart illness, and had a viral infection as well, and was put on lisinopril ACE inhibitors for 9 days. He's been off them for the past 9 days. Is there any concern or information that you would know on that?
Yes, that's what I alluded to earlier when I said, you know, heart disease, there was specific. What he's referencing is a BMJ article, which perhaps is linked, a physiological link between the angiotensin system and ACE inhibitors, which are sort of angiotensin converting enzyme blockers, which it's a bit complicated medically, but they're used really in the treatment of heart disease and high blood pressure, not so much for AFib. There could be a link there. You know, the BMJ article is obviously a very premature because we don't have many cases. It's something, you know, to speak to your cardiologist about. I don't know how strongly he needs the ACE inhibitor. A lot of times it's used for people who have left ventricular dysfunction, which means that their heart is not pumping normally, and they need it a lot more than people who don't have that and are just on it for high blood pressure, in which case maybe, you know, you can switch to something else if needed. Something you should talk to your cardiologist or doctor about. But yeah, there is a British Medical Journal article about that.
Roman Reigns, a case that I'm sure you're very familiar with, you know, had leukemia, has CML. So that's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like in his system for life in a sense. Is this a higher risk? Is he at higher risk than a normal wrestler?
So, yeah, Roman Reigns is likely on Gleevec, I would assume.
I'm pretty sure he is. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's not necessarily on strong immunosuppressives. That being said, cancer overall, you know, had about 6% is the number that they use out of China. It is lower down, so less than heart disease, less than diabetes, less than chronic lung disease. But, you know, it's there as an increased risk. So just having cancer alone could put him at higher risk than the general person. That being said, the type of cancer he has, he's not on immunosuppressive therapy or strong immunosuppressive therapy necessarily.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think if there's so as far as like advice on everyday life right now in the Bay Area and or in another area that's, you know, fairly significant, where this is a fairly significant problem, and in the whole country it's a problem at this stage. For going out, I mean, would you recommend staying home as much as possible? As far as going out, shopping, haircut, movies.
Those places could get shut down too, though, I guess.
The movie theaters here, from what I understand, are doing like a 50% thing where it's every other seat type of a thing. But I expect that the movie business is going to be an absolute disaster for a little while anyway. But, I can't even imagine going to the movies. What would you say would be everyday life safe, and what would you say try to avoid as much as possible?
So if you're in an area where you're having community spread, and the Bay Area is one, Washington State is obviously one, New York has that, there are some cases in Maryland and BC, then yeah, it's going to be a higher risk. You can get it just from being out in the community. Things you want to particularly avoid are where you're going to be in close proximity to others, and where you're going to have the ability to spread it by touching things that they're touching. So you certainly don't want to be touching a lot of people without good hand washing. You want to be able to maintain good hand washing if you can. So, you know, higher risk areas, I think the gym is certainly one where you share equipment, so that is a higher risk area. The malls are less risky. You know, dinner, it's theoretically possible, but again, less likely if you're going with people you know. If you're sick at all, then just stay home. If you are at higher risk, so I would think older people in particular, or you're on immunosuppressives, it's probably best to stay home as much as you can. For everyone else, you know, you can stay home as much as you can, but of course, there is that element that balances trying to live your life with that. And I think, you know, if you're going to be in those areas, you're safest to pick the lower risk activities where you're less likely to be exposed to people in a close setting. Make sure you have good hand hygiene and make sure that, you know, you are not being in close proximity to anyone that you know is sick or has traveled or is higher risk for having the disease.
We are definitely going to have to wipe down this microphone that we're sharing.
I know. Well, one thing really quick. So now as far as running, bike riding, playing basketball in, well, I don't know about basketball, but playing sports in the park, going roller skating, you know, going to taking kids to the, you know, the park or the, whatever the, you know, the, you know, slides and things like that. I mean, what would you recommend and what wouldn't you recommend right now?
So I think if, you know, if you're out running on your own, you're probably pretty low risk because you're not really coming in contact with others. And like I said, it's not airborne. It's not that somebody's going to spread it just from breathing down the corner from you. So you have to be in fairly close contact or touch something that they've spread their droplets on. So that's probably lower risk. You know, basketball, you are in close contact, right? So you got to be a bit careful with who you're playing with, obviously. If you're just going and shooting hoops alone, that's probably not high risk, obviously. In terms of the park, I mean, certainly you can spread it and kids are vaccinated for not washing their hands and touching things. So I might be a bit more cautious there than I would be for the other activities.
Well, you've been so great with your time. Really appreciate all of this information. I think, you know, not only, you know, we are mostly a wrestling and MMA podcast, but, you know, everybody can gain something from this information. So thanks again for joining. Is there a place where folks can follow you online if they're looking for some of the information that you may have?
You know, I don't have a big online presence, to be honest with you. I'm sort of, I'm actually on call at the hospital right now working. But yeah, if people have specific things, if they send it to Dave, he can certainly forward it to me. I'm more than happy to or take any questions if people have or anything like that. You know, I think the important message I wanted to get across, I think, is that we can make a difference in terms of altering the trajectory of this if we do our best not to overload the system. And that's really the main message I want to send is that if you are sitting at home worried about this, like most people are, there are things you can do to make sure that even those who get sick, and if it happens to be you or a loved one, have a much better chance than not.
Now, this is still, as far as the worst of it, I mean, when, with the numbers, I mean, it's like what I keep hearing is that it's, you know, age is a huge, huge factor, and that if you're under 60, it's not so bad, but you can carry it. But if you're over 60 or whatever the number is, I mean, your chances get worse and worse, especially if you're over 80 or something. I mean, how much of that is true? And you know, because people have told me, well, you know, there's really no danger for your kids as far as dying or anything. Is that still the case?
Yeah, so we know that this is based out of China, right, where we have the most information. So we know, for instance, that kids under the age of 10, nobody has died. That we do know. We know that the risk of death under the age of 40 is very low. So most of those times you're looking at, you know, less than a percentage or two. We know that most of the sickness occurs over 60, much more dramatically over 80 in terms of death. And that is from data in China. So we do know that, you know, if you're sort of under the age of 50, you know, the risk is not as high. Certainly under the age of 10, it's very, very, very low because nobody has really died. That being said, you know, when you infect enough people, you are going to get young people that get sick. It's just a percentage game. But in general, yes, it's going to be a disease of older people, and it's going to be a disease similar to influenza in that sense, where it's mainly older people that are affected, but you do get the occasional young person that's affected. That's probably the best way to look at it.
All right, is that it?
That's I guess I have one more personal question in the sense of, and it's kind of out of my hands. I mean, my mother's almost 91 years old, and she's in a place where they have completely locked down. I mean, no one's allowed in at all. It's a care center. And I mean, is there any, do you have any kind of an idea of when I can see my mom again? Because that's, you know, a really, that's when this, that's probably hitting me as hard as anything right now on a personal level.
No, I mean, I totally understand. We have patients in our ICU who, when they're suspected of having COVID, we don't allow family members in. And, you know, they see their loved one go into an ICU and may never see them again. Yeah. So, unfortunately, you know, with your mom being in a situation where she's elderly and at higher risk, and certainly not just her, but if somebody were to bring in a disease into that area, they could spread it to any number of people. I can see why they've opted to be quite aggressive.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of when you can go back again, you would need to see, I think, a decreasing number of cases. So, if you started to see the caseload drop off, and, you know, the best estimates are probably in the order of 3 months, they would certainly start. What they may end up doing, and what I suspect, is that if we start to get a little bit of a drop off, we start to hit the top, they may start letting people in as long as they're asymptomatic. So they'll screen you and say, you know, have you had symptoms and have you not? And if we get good evidence, you know, that once you get this, you're clear and you're not getting a game, that could be a marker too. We're a bit premature to make that call, but that could be another sign that they may eventually say, okay, you're okay to come in. But I would think for the next little bit, while the case rises sort of exponentially, they're not going to do that until we start to see a drop off. And at that point, I think they would move to screening for symptoms before they let you in.
Okay.
All right. Well, really appreciate it again. Thanks for all of your time. And I don't know if you want to have to do this again, but you know, if this thing gets worse, maybe.
Yeah, we'll have to play everything. Well, we're playing everything by ear for the next couple months.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dr. Patel.
Thanks.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me on.